gods or most stories of miracles seriously. They believed in the advancement of knowledge and something like progress. New information provided the intellectual bricks and mortar for new types of knowledge. As Isaac Newton developed his laws of gravity, he had access to an unprecedented range of information. He could, for example, compare how pendulums swung in Paris with how they swung in the Americas and Africa. No previous generation of scientists could have tested their ideas so thoroughly or within such wide and varied networks of information. Newton's achievement can be tied to the vast increase in general knowledge that overseas trade and exploration had brought to Europeans. The courage to generalize, to arrive at universals about the natural world, owes much to the immense quantity of information and self-confidence that European mastery of the great seas gave land-bound thinkers like Isaac Newton. Dazzling new flows of wealth and information had one more powerful effect. They stimulated the commercial forms of mobilization often described as capitalism, that were driven by gradients of both wealth and information. For the most part, traditional rulers had mobilized wealth with the threat of coercion, the promise of protection, and appeals to religious and legal authorities. But in all civilizations, merchants had also mobilized a lot of wealth through commerce. Commercial mobilization depended on arbitrage, on buying cheap in one region and selling dear somewhere else. To succeed, merchants needed wealth to invest and information about what to invest it in. The steep gradients of wealth and information in the first global exchange networks opened such vast commercial opportunities for European merchants and entrepreneurs that their wealth and political influence increased until even emperors, such as the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, began to borrow from merchants. European rulers were generally keener to work with merchants than traditional rulers such as the Ming emperors of China had been, because most European states had modest resources, fought endless wars, and were constantly short of cash. And rulers who borrowed from merchants were naturally eager to support commerce. In this way, there emerged a close symbiotic relationship between European traders and rulers. Rulers protected and supported commerce, and in return, they got the right to tax and profit from commercial wealth. This was the earliest and crudest form of capitalism, a system admired by European economists from Adam Smith to Karl Marx. The emerging partnership between European governments and entrepreneurs took many forms. The Russian trade in vodka is a case in point. Distilling appeared in 16th century Russia. Almost immediately, officials in the government of Ivan the Terrible, whose nickname refers to his brutal treatment of his own nobles, realized that if they could stop peasants from distilling at home, which wasn't hard to do, because distilling required a great deal of skill and equipment, they could make a lot of money, as liquor would be one of the few goods that peasants had to buy from others. It was a powerful mind-altering substance, and rapidly became obligatory for peasants, who used it to celebrate the great religious and family festivals, as well as marriages and funerals. But taking vodka into thousands of villages scattered over a large area was a demanding task, and one best suited to merchants. So in partnership with its merchants, the Russian government built up a trade in vodka so profitable that by the 19th century it was paying for much of the cost of the Russian army, then one of the largest in the world. Russian governments and society paid a significant entropy tax for the complex revenue pumps of the vodka trade, which eventually led to high and dangerous levels of alcoholism. Though capitalism generated new forms of inequality, economists admired it because it was also good at generating both wealth and innovation. Many early economists understood perfectly well that the wealth traded by and generated by capitalists really represented control over compressed sunlight, over energy flows through the biosphere. That is why so many subscribed to a labor theory of value. Labor, after all, was energy. But they also understood that capitalism was particularly good at encouraging innovation in control over energy. This was because merchants, unlike traditional rulers, could rarely use naked force to mobilize wealth, though they were happy to do so if they got the chance. For the most part, merchants had to use guile rather than force. That meant seeking out new information. They had to find new commodities and markets, and they had to trade efficiently and cut costs. Above all, they had to innovate if they wanted to outsmart their rivals. They had to find new ways of mobilizing and controlling flows of energy and resources. This helps explain why the increasingly capitalistic societies of Europe became both wealthier and more innovative in the centuries after Columbus first crossed the Atlantic. Some governments, such as those of the Netherlands or Venice, were ruled by merchants, so they took commerce very seriously indeed. The British learned much from the Dutch, and briefly, in the late 17th century, they even had a Dutch king, William III. British government spent huge amounts on a navy that could protect fortified trading bases and colonies in the Caribbean, North America, and eventually India. With naval protection, British governments and merchants made huge profits. For example, they sold arms to African rulers in return for slaves, which they transported to the Americas under appalling conditions. The slaves were traded for sugar, tobacco, and other plantation goods, whose prices were kept low because slave labor was cheap. That meant that plantation goods could be sold cheaply and profitably on the rapidly expanding consumer markets of England and Europe. The British government, like the Dutch, became increasingly dependent on revenues from trade, including customs payments. That helps explain why, in 1694, the government established the Bank of England to make cheap loans available to British merchants, entrepreneurs, and landlords. In the 18th century, cheap loans encouraged agricultural innovation and helped build canals and an extensive system of coach transport. London grew into one of the world's largest cities, and British commerce boomed. New flows of wealth and information and new forms of scientific knowledge stimulated innovation in agriculture, mining, shipbuilding and navigation, canal construction, and many other areas. They did so particularly in Western Europe. After 1500, wealth and power began to shift fast, and the former backwaters of Europe and the Atlantic region rapidly became a new hub, the center of the first global flows of wealth, information, and power. Fossil fuels, a mega innovation. A globalized world and an increasingly wealthy and powerful entrepreneurial class, supported by local rulers, stimulated commerce and innovation, particularly in the Atlantic region. But as we have seen, some innovations are more transformative than others. Not surprisingly, given Europe's increasing wealth, entrepreneurial dynamism, and information flows, The mega-informations that would create the modern world popped up here, rather than in the older hub regions that reached across Eurasia from the Mediterranean through the Muslim world to China. The most important mega-innovations were usually those that released new flows of energy, such as fusion or photosynthesis. Farming counts as a mega-innovation because it let farmers tap larger shares of energy flows from recent photosynthesis. Those increasing flows drove the turbulent changes of the agrarian era. But there were limits to the energy flows from farming because it tapped only recently captured sunlight. Burn a piece of wood, eat a carrot, or harness a horse to a plow, and you are tapping energy flows captured from sunlight in the past 12 months, or at most, in recent decades. By the late 18th century, some economists in Western Europe began to suspect that European societies were exploiting these flows to the fullest. Their calculations were simple. The energy flows that powered human societies came from croplands and woodlands, with a small bonus from wind and rain. So growth meant finding more arable land and woodland. By 1800, it seemed that most farmable land was already being farmed. Adam Smith, the founder of modern economics, argued that societies would soon be using all available energy. Then growth would stall, wages would fall, and so too, world populations, as farming societies came face to face with the limits on energy flows that all other organisms do when they have filled up their niche. Some societies, such as the Netherlands and England, already seemed to be pushing at these limits. In the Netherlands, farmers had to gouge farmland from the sea, while England faced growing shortages of timber for heating, housing, and shipbuilding. By Adam Smith's time, as Alfred Crosby puts it, humanity had hit a ceiling in its utilization of sun energy. Pressure to find new sources of energy would eventually conjure up the mega innovations that we describe today as the fossil fuels revolution. These gave humans access to flows of energy much greater than those provided by farming. The energy locked up in fossil fuels. Energy that had accumulated not over a few decades, but since the Carboniferous period, more than 360 million years earlier. In seams of coal, oil, and gas lay several hundred million years' worth of buried sunlight in solid, liquid, and gaseous forms. To get a sense of the energies locked up in fossil fuels, imagine carrying a car full of passengers over your head and running very, very fast for several hours. Then remind yourself that a few gallons of gasoline pack that much energy and more, because a lot of the energy is wasted. Like a gold strike, this energy bonanza generated frenzied and often chaotic new forms of change and created and destroyed the fortunes of individuals, countries, and entire regions. Charles Dickens, Friedrich Engels, and others saw the terrible price that many paid for these changes. But from the frenzy would emerge an entirely new world. The transformations began with technological breakthroughs that turned the energy of coal into cheap mechanical energy that could power factories, locomotives, steamships, and turbines. Many societies already knew about coal, but it was difficult to mine and transport, and dirty and smelly when burned. So most people in agrarian societies preferred to get their heat energy from wood. In some regions, though, wood was scarce. In England, as populations grew, cities expanded, particularly London, and commerce boomed, demand for energy began to outstrip supplies. England was one of the first countries in the world to feel the energy squeeze. But unlike most countries, England had a fallback. It had large reserves of coal quite close to the surface, much of it near rivers or the coast, so it could be transported cheaply and easily by sea or canals to the major cities, including London. English manufacturers and households began switching over to coal. By the 17th century, English brewers, brickmakers, and bakers were using coal, and Londoners began to complain about the city's foul air. By 1700, coal was producing 50% of English energy. By 1750, it was supplying as much energy as 4 million hectares of woodlands, the equivalent of almost 15% of the area of England and Wales. Dependence on coal encouraged those who mined, transported, and sold it to produce more coal and produce it more cheaply. But there was a problem. As demand for coal increased, coal miners had to dig deeper mines, which soon filled up with water. So getting more coal depended on building efficient pumps to drain mines. In England, the incentives to solve this technological problem were greater than anywhere, so designing cheap, efficient pumps became a major goal for entrepreneurs and inventors. The combination of new science and widespread mechanical skills provided the intellectual background needed to solve the problem. 17th century scientists had begun to understand how atmospheric pressure worked, and by the early 18th century, that knowledge was put to use in Newcomen steam engines to pump water from coal mines. But the Newcomen steam engine was inefficient and used huge quantities of coal, so it made commercial sense only in coal mines where coal was cheap. Investors, inventors, and engineers understood that improved pumps could earn them huge profits and revolutionize the supply of coal to English homes and industries. James Watt, the engineer who eventually solved these technical problems, was a Scottish instrument maker, well connected to engineers, scientists, and businessmen. While on a Sunday afternoon stroll in 1765, Watt suddenly figured out that he could make the Newcomen engine more efficient by adding a second cylinder that acted as a condenser. But building the improved steam engine involved cutting-edge science and technology, and the ability to design and bore precisely engineered pistons that could withstand high pressures. The task was demanding and expensive. However, Watt's main backer, Matthew Boulton, sensed an opportunity and invested heavily in Watt's research. He understood the huge profits that could be made from a machine that turned the energy of coal into mechanical energy at a reasonable cost. By 1769, when Watt acquired a first patent on his design, competition was so intense that after Boulton bragged about Watt's prototypes to the Russian ambassador in London, Watt got a lucrative job offer from the Russian government. Watt seriously considered taking the offer, but Boulton persuaded him to stay. By 1776, the work was done. The James Watt steam engine gave a first taste of energy flows so vast that they would transform human societies in just two centuries. Like the activation energies that kickstart chemical reactions, energy from fossil fuels provided a pulse of energy that started the technological equivalent of a global chain reaction. Within 25 years, 500 of the new machines were at work in England, and by the 1830s, coal-fired steam engines were the main source of power in British industry. English consumption of energy soared. By 1850, England and Wales were consuming 9 times as much energy as Italy, and English entrepreneurs and factories had access to prime movers of colossal power. Steam locomotives could generate 200,000 watts of energy. Yes, James Watt gave his name to the unit, or about 200 times the energy supplied by a two-horse plough team, one of the most important prime movers of the agrarian era. More cheap energy was available than ever before. English industry took off. Coal was generating as much energy as could have been extracted from woodlands covering 150% of the area of England and Wales. Early industrialization. England was the first country to benefit from the energy bonanza of fossil fuels, and production took off. By the middle of the 19th century, England produced a fifth of global GDP, gross domestic product, and about half of global fossil fuel emissions. Not surprisingly, global levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide began to rise from the middle of the 19th century. And as early as 1896, the Swedish chemist Svante Arrhenius recognized both that carbon dioxide was a greenhouse gas and that it was being generated in large enough amounts to start changing global climates. But such fears belonged to the future. Arrhenius actually thought global warming was a positive development because it might stave off a new ice age. Meanwhile, entrepreneurs and governments in other countries wanted a share in the bonanza of cheap energy and tried to beg, borrow, or steal the new technology. Steam engines were soon being built in Europe and in the newly independent United States. As they spread, they stimulated waves of new breakthrough technologies, such as the steam locomotive and steamship, each of which cheapened transportation and spun off related innovations, particularly in the manufacture of iron and steel for rolling stock, hulls, and tracks. Entrepreneurs, engineers, and scientists explored new ways of exploiting the cheap energy from steam engines in building and textile manufacturing. There were many powerful feedback loops. Improved steam engines allowed access to deeper mines, which lowered the cost of extracting coal, so the amount of coal that was mined increased by 55 times between 1800 and 1900. Cheaper coal made steam engines more economical, while steamships and locomotives slashed the cost of transporting cattle, coal, produce, and people by land and sea, which stimulated global trade. Railways increased demand for iron and steel, and innovations in steel production made it economical for the first time to use steel in mass-produced goods, such as tin cans, a new way of storing and preserving foodstuffs. There were unexpected side effects. Using steam to spin and weave textiles increased the demand for raw cotton, which stimulated cotton planting in the United States, Central Asia, and Egypt. Industrial production of textiles increased demand for subsidiary products, such as artificial dyes and bleaches, which kick-started the modern chemicals industry, many of whose products came from coal. Cheap energy encouraged experimentation and investment in many new technologies. One of the most important was electricity. In the 1820s, Michael Faraday realized that you could generate an electric current by moving a metal coil inside an electric field. Large-scale electricity generation became possible in the 1860s with the invention of generators powered by steam engines. Electricity and electric motors, like the proton pumps and ATP molecules of the earliest prokaryotes, provided efficient new ways of distributing power. Transformed into electricity, power could be sent cheaply to both factories and individual homes. Light bulbs transformed home life and factory work by turning night into day, and cities, highways, and ports began to light up at night. Electricity also revolutionized communications. At the beginning of the 19th century, the fastest way of sending a message by land was still by horse courier. The telegraph, invented in 1837, allowed communication at the speed of light. By the end of the 19th century, telephones and radios made it possible to transmit real conversations more or less instantaneously over huge distances. New technologies revolutionized warfare and weaponry. Railways and steamships moved armies and weapons faster than ever before. In 1866, Alfred Nobel invented dynamite, a powerful new explosive. Along with improved handguns and machine guns, explosives multiplied the killing power of each soldier. The destructive power of industrial weapons became clear during the American Civil War, the first real fossil fuels war, and steam-powered iron-hulled ships equipped with modern weapons transformed naval warfare, allowing Britain to conquer the navies of Imperial China during the Opium Wars. In the late 19th century, supported by the wealth, the technologies, and the energy flows of the Industrial Revolution, the countries of once backward Europe began to conquer much of the world during the era of imperialism. Multiple feedback loops, most traceable ultimately to new flows of cheap energy, explain the extraordinary dynamism of the Industrial Revolution and the rapidly increasing wealth and power of the first regions to industrialize. Cheap energy enabled and stimulated innovation and investment in country after country, and in many different areas of manufacturing and industry. Eventually, cheap energy from coal would encourage innovations that mobilized new forms of fossil fuel energy from oil. Oil, like coal, was familiar. It was extracted wherever it seeped to the surface and used to make bitumen, medicine, even incendiary weapons. In the mid-19th century, oil in the form of kerosene began to be used for lighting as an alternative to whale oil, the price of which was rising as whales were overhunted. But mineral oil was in limited supply. Some suspected there were large amounts deep underground that could be tapped using drilling techniques imported from China, where special drills had been designed to extract rock salt. Indeed, it was known that oil was sometimes found by those drilling for salt. The first serious attempt to drill for oil was conducted by Edwin Drake in the impoverished Pennsylvania town of Titusville, beginning in 1857. On August 27, 1859, just before funds ran out, Drake's drill team struck oil. Prospectors rushed to buy up land, and within 15 months, there were 75 oil wells in and around Titusville. "They barter prices in claims and shares," wrote a visitor. "Buy and sell sites and report the depth, show or yield of wells, etc., etc. Those who leave today tell others of the well they saw yielding 50 barrels of pure oil a day. The story sends more back tomorrow. Never was a hive of bees in time of swarming more astir or making a greater buzz." In 1861, drillers struck the first gusher, an oil well that pumped oil under its own pressure, even producing a fatal explosion when the natural gas pumped up with the oil was ignited. Production increased to 3,000 barrels a day. Many made fortunes from oil, but not Edwin Drake, who died in poverty in 1880, despite the fact that he had helped launch the next chapter of the fossil fuels revolution. Chapter 11. The Anthropocene. Threshold 8. An outburst at a conference in 2000 from Paul Crutzen. We're no longer in the Holocene. We're in the Anthropocene. From Understanding Media by Marshall McLuhan. Man, the food gatherer, reappears incongruously as information gatherer. In this role, electronic man is no less a nomad than his Paleolithic ancestors. In the 20th century, we humans began to transform our surroundings, our societies, and even ourselves. Without really intending to, we have introduced changes so rapid and so massive that our species has become the equivalent of a new geological force. That is why many scholars have begun to argue that planet Earth has entered a new geological age, the Anthropocene epoch, or the era of humans. This is the first time in the 4 billion year history of the biosphere that a single biological species has become the dominant force for change. In just a century or two, building on the huge energy flows and the remarkable innovations of the fossil fuels revolution, we humans have stumbled into the role of planetary pilots without really knowing what instruments we should be looking at, what buttons we should be pressing, or where we are trying to land. This is new territory for humans and for the entire biosphere. The Great Acceleration. If we stand back from the details, the Anthropocene epoch looks like a drama with three main acts so far and a lot more change still in the works. Act 1 began in the mid-19th century as fossil fuel technologies began to transform the entire world. A few countries in the Atlantic region gained colossal wealth and power and terrifying new weapons of war. A huge gap opened between the first fossil fuel powers and the rest of the world. That gap in power and wealth would last for more than a century and start closing only in the late 20th century. These differences created the lopsided imperial world of the late 19th century and early 20th centuries. Suddenly, countries of the Atlantic region, which had been marginal for much of the agrarian era, began to dominate and sometimes rule much of the world, including most of Africa and much of the territory once ruled by the great Asian empires of India and China. Outside the new Atlantic hub zone, the first impact of fossil fuel technologies was mainly destructive because the new technologies arrived in the military baggage of foreign invaders. The Nemesis, the first iron-hulled steam-powered gunship, with its 17 cannons and its ability to sail fast in shallow waters, helped England win control of China's ports during the First Opium War, from 1839 to 1842. The Chinese Navy, once the greatest in the world, had no defense against such weapons. Within decades, Europe's commercial and military power had undermined ancient states and lifeways. Textile production using spinning and weaving machines powered by steam engines ruined artisan textile producers in India, which had been the agrarian era's leading producer of cotton cloth. As Britain gained political and military control of the Indian subcontinent, it locked in these imbalances by keeping Indian textiles out of British markets. Even the building of India's major railroads benefited Britain more than India. Most of the track and rolling stock was manufactured in Britain, and the huge Indian rail network was designed primarily to move British troops quickly and cheaply, to export cheap Indian raw materials, and to import English manufactured goods. In the Americas, Africa, and Asia, growing demand for sugar, cotton, rubber, tea, and other raw materials encouraged environmentally destructive plantations, often worked by quasi-slave labor. In wars that pitted machine guns against spears and assegais, European powers carved up Africa and ruled it for the best part of a century. Europe's economic, political, and military conquests encouraged a sense of European or Western superiority. And many Europeans began to see their conquests as part of a European or Western mission to civilize and modernize the rest of the world. To them, industrialization was a sign of progress. It was part of a transformative mission, first advocated in the Enlightenment to improve the world, to make it a better, richer, and more civilized place for humans. Act II of the Anthropocene was exceptionally violent. It began in the late 19th century and lasted until the middle of the 20th century. During this act, the first fossil fuel powers turned on one another. In the late 19th century, the United States, France, Germany, Russia, and Japan began to challenge Britain's industrial leadership. As rivalries intensified, the major powers tried to protect their markets and sources of supply and keep out competitors. International trade declined. In 1914, rivalry turned into outright war. For 30 years, destructive global wars mobilized the new technologies and the growing wealth and populations of the modern era. Other parts of the world were sucked into these wars, and they were fought with as much brutality in China and Japan as they were in Russia and Germany. As the red mist of war descended over Europe, Africa, Asia, and the Pacific, warring governments competed to develop more destructive weapons. Science gave the combatants terrifying new weapons, some of which tapped the energies lurking within atomic nuclei. On August 6, 1945, a U.S. B-29 Superfortress bomber flew from the Mariana Islands in the Pacific and dropped an atomic bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima. It destroyed much of the city and killed 80,000 people. Within a year, another 70,000 had died from injuries and radiation. On August 9, 1945, a similar weapon was dropped on the city of Nagasaki. Act III includes the second half of the 20th century and the early 21st century. From the bloodbath of the world wars, the United States and the Soviet Union emerged as the first global superpowers. There were many local wars, most aimed at overthrowing European colonial rule. But there were no more major international wars during the era of the Cold War. By now, all powers understood that there would be no victors in a nuclear war. But there were some close shaves. Soon after the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, President John Kennedy admitted that the odds of an all-out nuclear war had been between 1 out of 3 and even. The 4 decades after World War II witnessed the most remarkable spurt of economic growth in human history. This was the period of the Great Acceleration. Global exchanges were renewed and intensified. In the 40 years before World War I, according to one influential estimate, international trade increased in value at an average rate of about 3.4% a year. From 1914 to 1950, the rate fell to just 0.9%. Then, from 1950 to 1973, it rose at about 7.9% a year, before falling slightly to about 5.1% between 1973 and 1998. In 1948, 20 nations signed the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, GATT, which lowered barriers to international trade. Wartime technologies were now put to more peaceful uses. Oil and natural gas added to the energy bonanza of the 19th century, and so did nuclear power, the peaceful counterpart of nuclear weapons. Productivity soared, first in the leading fossil fuel economies and then elsewhere. Consumption soared too, as output rose and producers sought new markets at home as well as abroad. In wealthier countries, this was the age of the automobile, of TV, of suburban dream houses, and eventually of computers, smartphones, and the internet. A new middle class started to emerge. This was also when the Industrial Revolution began to spread beyond the old industrial heartlands. By the early 21st century, industrial technologies had transformed much of Asia, South America, and parts of Africa as completely and as fast as they had once transformed European societies. As other areas of the world industrialized, their wealth and power increased. There began to appear, once again, a world with multiple hubs of power and wealth. Within 250 years of the first modern steam engine, fossil fuel technologies had transformed the entire planet. During the Great Acceleration, humans mobilized energy and resources on such an unprecedented scale that they began to transform the biosphere. That is why many scholars date the dawn of the Anthropocene epoch to the middle of the 20th century. Transforming the world. Technologies and science. Innovation, propelled by cheap energy, was the main driver of change. Innovations created steeper gradients of wealth and power that encouraged competition, which drove innovation in a powerful feedback cycle. Entrepreneurs and governments hunted down the innovations that might give them an industrial or military edge, and invested in the businesses and scientists, the schools, universities, and research institutes that could generate and disseminate new technologies and skills. The wars of the early 20th century drove a forced march of innovation. During World War I, Germany ran short of natural fertilizers, and German scientists, led by Fritz Haber and Karl Bosch, figured out how to draw nitrogen from the air to make artificial fertilizers. Nitrogen doesn't like to react, so this was not easy. Prokaryotes had solved the problem billions of years ago. But Haber and Bosch were the first multicellular organisms to successfully fix atmospheric nitrogen. The Haber-Bosch process uses huge amounts of energy to overcome nitrogen's reluctance to combine chemically, so it was viable only in a world of fossil fuels. But artificial nitrogen-based fertilizers transformed agriculture, raised the productivity of arable land throughout the world, and made it possible to feed several billion more humans. It turned fossil fuel energy into food. A liquid fossil fuel, oil, was first used in the late 19th century as a replacement for whale oil in lighting. The first internal combustion engines, developed in the 1860s and 1870s, showed how to generate mechanical force from oil. Unlike the steam engine, whose heat source was external to the engine's moving parts, in internal combustion engines, the heat from fossil fuels drove pistons or rotors or turbine blades directly. Internal combustion engines spread rapidly in the late 20th century, largely because of their wartime use to transport soldiers and equipment and to power the first tanks. They were also installed in the first military aircraft, which pioneered the dark art of dropping explosives from the air. Once the wars ended, manufacturers of automobiles and planes turned to civilian markets to create a world in which more and more individuals owned and used cars or flew in planes. Global trade was transformed by oil tankers, container ships, and large planes. Information lies at the heart of Anthropocene technologies. Information technologies were transformed when governments invested in a massive expansion of education and research, and businesses and corporations funded research to develop and disseminate new products and services. To break enemy codes, wartime governments funded research into the mathematics of information and computing. This research, combined with the invention of the transistor in the late 1940s, laid the foundations for the computerization of science, business, government, finance, and everyday life in the second half of the century. Rocketry, also developed during the wars, would eventually send humans into space. Wartime governments had launched huge research programs to develop nuclear weapons. The American government's Manhattan Project developed the first atomic bombs, including the weapons dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. These unleashed the energies of disintegrating uranium nuclei. The Soviet Union soon developed its own atomic weapons, helped by information leaked by spies from the Manhattan Project. Within a decade, the United States and the Soviet Union had also built hydrogen bombs, which released the much greater energies generated by proton fusion, the same mechanism that powers all stars. The first H-bomb was tested in 1952. Much of this innovation was inspired by breakthroughs in the supercharged collective learning environment of modern science. Albert Einstein developed his theory of relativity in the first two decades of the 20th century. It improved on Newton's understanding of the universe by showing that matter and energy warped space and time. And this warping was the real source of gravity. Einstein also showed that matter could be converted into energy, and that insight provided the scientific foundations for nuclear weapons and nuclear power. Quantum physics, developed in the same era, gave deeper insight into the strange probabilistic world of atomic nuclei. Without that understanding, nuclear weapons, transistors, global positioning systems, and modern computers would not exist today. In the 1920s, astronomers such as Edwin Hubble found the first evidence that our universe began in a Big Bang. In biology, Darwin's idea of natural selection was combined with Mendel's understanding of heredity and the improved statistical methods of R.A. Fisher to lay the foundations for modern genetics. These and many other new insights and technologies powered innovation and growth during the Great Acceleration. Increased productivity allowed human populations to grow faster than ever before. In 1800, there were 900 million humans on Earth. By 1900, there were 1.5 billion. By 1950, when I was a child, there were 2.5 billion humans, despite the huge casualties of the world wars. During my lifetime, human numbers have increased by another 5 billion. Such enormous numbers can numb the brain, so it's worth taking the time to grasp what they mean. In the 200 years since 1800, the number of humans increased by more than 6 billion. Each additional human had to be fed, clothed, housed, and employed, and most had to be educated. The challenge of producing enough resources in just 200 years to support an extra 6 billion humans was colossal. Remarkably, the challenge was met with modern technologies, modern fossil fuels, and modern managerial skills. Productivity soared in agriculture, manufacturing, and transportation, though food and other supplies did not always get to those who needed them. Enough food was produced to feed more than 7 billion people. The crucial changes were in the production of artificial fertilizers and pesticides, the use of fossil-fueled farm machinery, the building of thousands of irrigation dams, and the production of new genetically modified crops. Modern farming technologies brought new land into cultivation, increasing the farmed area from 500 million hectares in 1860 to almost 3 times as much in 1960. Fishing trawlers equipped with powerful diesel engines, sonar detection equipment, and massive nets sucked up most of the organisms in the area they fished. The fish catch rose from 19 million tons to 94 million tons between 1950 and 2000, though overfishing means that many fisheries are now in danger of collapse. Improved information technologies made it easier to accumulate, store, keep track of, and use the huge amounts of information that drove innovation and kept hugely complex modern societies running. Communications and transportation technologies transformed collective learning by creating, for the first time, a single linked network of minds that spanned the globe and could manage and track down new information in colossal electronic stores of information. The noosphere, the sphere of mind, became a dominant driver of change within the biosphere. Cheap but powerful networked computers gave billions of people access to more information than they could have found in all the libraries of the pre-modern world. When combined with the mathematically sophisticated techniques of modern statistical analysis, computers allowed governments, banks, corporations, and individuals to keep track of huge flows of resources. They also allowed instant communication between individuals anywhere in the world through telegrams, phones, and the internet. If the sharing of information is what makes us humans so powerful, computers multiplied that power many times over. As always, there were losses too. Just as memory skills probably declined with the spread of writing, so calculating skills declined with the spread of computers and calculators. By 2000, the fossil fuels revolution embraced most of the world, including many older hub regions. The yawning gaps in national wealth and power of the late 19th century began to close. European powers, weakened by the world wars, grudgingly gave up their colonies, and older hub regions in Asia, the Eastern Mediterranean, North Africa, and the Americas began to catch up in technology, wealth, and power. Behind all these changes was the bonanza of cheap energy from fossil fuels. Coal production increased everywhere, but so did the production of oil and natural gas. New oil fields were developed in Arabia, Iran, the Soviet Union, and even along the continental shelves. In the Middle East alone, oil production increased from 28 billion barrels in 1948 to 367 billion barrels in 1972, just 25 years later. Natural gas came into its own during the Great Acceleration. Total energy consumption doubled in the 19th century and then rose by 10 times in the 20th century. Human consumption of energy rose much faster than human populations. Transforming the world, governance, and society. The very nature of society and government was transformed by the new energy flows and technologies of the Anthropocene. Once, all humans had been foragers, and government really meant family relationships. After farming appeared, more and more people lived in peasant villages and supported themselves by farming. In farming societies, government meant, above all, mobilizing energy and resources from peasants. Today, most humans no longer gather or farm to produce their food and other necessities. They have become wage earners. Like the potters of ancient Sumer, they live on wages earned by doing specialized work. And that transformed the nature of government. Because now governments had to become involved in the day-to-day lives of all their citizens. This is because wage earners, unlike peasants, cannot survive without governments. Farming villages could exist quite happily beyond the borders of the great agrarian civilizations. But wage earners depend on the existence of laws, markets, employers, shops, and currencies. A specialist wage earner, like a nerve cell, cannot survive alone. This is why a world of wage earners is much more tightly integrated than a world of peasant farmers. Modern governments regulate markets and currencies, protect the businesses that provide employment, create mass educational systems that can spread literacy to most of the population, and provide the infrastructure for the movement of goods and workers. To do all this, they have to draw more and more of their subjects into the work of government and administration. We can see the changeover to modern types of government in the 19th century as industrialization took off. More and more peasants became wage workers, and governments began to mobilize more of their populations. Revolutionary France, transformed by revolution and under attack from most of Europe, was one of the first modern states to recruit soldiers systematically from the entire population. The government of the United States was also forged in a period of war during which it had to mobilize much of the population. To do that, governments needed detailed records on the number of citizens, on their health and fitness, on their education, skills, wealth, and loyalty. These were problems most traditional governments had been able to ignore. The governments of revolutionary France and the United States began to mobilize the loyalty of their subjects through democratization, which brought more of the population into the work of government, and through nationalism, which appealed to people's sense of a shared national community. They offered increasing numbers of their subjects, wealthy men, other men, and women, in that order, some role in government through elections. Through schools and the rapidly developing news media, governments tried to reach into the minds of their subjects and generate new forms of loyalty. Nationalism proved a powerful way of uniting people with different traditions, religions, and even languages. It mobilized traditional instincts of kinship by constructing in the minds of citizens a vast imagined family of millions of people to whom they owed loyalty, service, and in the extreme crises of war, perhaps even their lives. The total wars of the early 20th century turned governments into economic managers as they tried to mobilize all the people and resources of modern industrial economies. We can roughly track the increasing role of government in economic management. In the late 19th century, the French government accounted for about 15% of French GDP, a very rough measure of total national production. At the time, that seemed like a lot. Contemporary governments in Britain and the United States accounted for less than 10% of their GDP. The wars of the early 20th century forced governments to intervene more actively in economic management. And by the middle of the 20th century, their economic role had increased everywhere. In the early 21st century, the average share of national